Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Later in the hour, some of Kentucky's great writers, Joseph Anthony, Crystal Wilkinson, Silas House, and Georgia Green Stamper, will have some stories for you, each in its own way, about this season of holidays. First, even in a time when political lines feel so sharply drawn, the one issue in Kentucky that keeps pulling people back to common ground is early childhood education. Support for investing in our youngest learners is coming from both sides of the aisle and with unusual force. Eastern Standard Education contributor Bridget Blom and her guest look at why this consensus is holding, what it means for families across the Commonwealth, where the momentum might take us next, and in the bargain, they remind us that public policy can be personal.
The data is striking. 91% of Kentucky voters agree that access to high-quality childcare is essential for parents to be able to work. 63% of Kentucky parents say the state isn't doing enough to ensure that access. And 99% of voters believe expanding high-quality preschool for 3 to 5-year-olds is important. This shared understanding across geography, ideology, and income forms the backdrop for the work to expand access to high-quality early childhood education that has been building and growing across the state for many years. Childcare isn't just a service for families. It's the workforce behind the workforce. And without strong, stable, early learning options, Kentucky struggles to keep parents working and to give young children the foundation they need to succeed in school, in their careers, and throughout their lives. In June 2025, the governor's office established the Pre-K for All Advisory Committee, bringing together leaders from education, childcare, business, government, and workforce development. It's a bipartisan group doing nonpartisan work, examining how expanding preschool can strengthen outcomes for kids, support working families, and boost Kentucky's economy. And at the center of this effort is today's guest, Sam Flynn, Executive Director of the Kentucky Pre-K for All Program and Special Advisor to Governor Beshear. Sam is helping lead the state's push to build the early childhood system Kentuckians demand, one that ensures every child gets a strong start. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Sam.
Thank you so much, Bridget. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I want to ground our conversation in the context that is Kentucky. Early learning, preschool, is no stranger to the way the state thinks about improving education outcomes. Kentucky has a long legacy in early childhood education. Back in 1990, the Kentucky Education Reform Act positioned us at the forefront nationally. Can you share a bit of that back picture to ground today's moment in Kentucky's history?
Sure, Bridget, and thank you so much for having me. It's really exciting to be here and to be talking about early childhood education and our Pre-K for All initiative. You're right on point with it's important to understand context and where these programs are, but more importantly, where they came from to be able to make decisions about where we're going to go from here. So as you mentioned, Kentucky's preschool program is not new. We have had a preschool program in Kentucky since 1990 with the passage of CARA. Going back even further than that, there was a lawsuit in the 80s, the Rose case, that was a lawsuit that was brought by a bunch of concerned citizens against the state to require the General Assembly to fully fund education in Kentucky in accordance with what our Constitution says. And Kentucky's Constitution has written in our values, which is that education is paramount in the Commonwealth because of all the things that it can do. So following that decision, CARA was passed. Part of CARA was establishing a preschool program in Kentucky. Now, that program started out as servicing children with serious disabilities and those that were under 130% of the federal poverty line. Now, that has expanded twice over the course of time, once under a Republican governor, then Governor Fletcher, who increased that qualification for at-risk or kids that are under 130% of the federal poverty line up to 150%. That was expanded once more in 2014, I believe, under Governor Steve Beshear, and then it was expanded once more to 200% of the federal poverty line in 2018, but that was line item vetoed by then Governor Matt Bevin. So what does that mean in terms of the actual numbers? So we have about 54,000 four-year-olds in Kentucky. We serve about 25 to 27% of those in our pre-K programs. Our pre-K program serves three-year-olds with serious disabilities, four-year-olds with serious disabilities, and those that are under 160% of the federal poverty line. That four-year-old population, which is what we're specifically dealing with pre-K for all, is about 14,000 and change students each year, give or take a few. It's been higher, it's been lower in the past. About half of those have serious disabilities and qualify in that way. About half of those are under that federal poverty line, 160%. Now, to bring it down to the personal level, 160% of the federal poverty line, we're throwing that around a little bit. What does that actually mean? That means a single mother making about $35,000 a year who has one child makes too much to qualify. Say that again, too much to qualify, making $17 an hour. For a family of four, it's $50,000 a year. Now, for a lot of families of four, in many cases, the economics are not there for that family to be able to afford private childcare or send their child to a nonprofit. And they likely don't qualify for Head Start and may not qualify for childcare subsidies, depending on where their income is. So a lot of people are really stuck in that spot. And so we're really aimed and focused on addressing that challenge that we've heard from so many Kentuckians. I know that's a long way of explaining the background to this, but I do think it's important to understand the broader context and bring it down again to that personal level and those challenges that regular Kentuckians are facing every day.
Yeah. Why is expanding access now such a priority for Governor Beshear?
So for a number of reasons, I think the first and foremost is this has been an education first administration. It has been since its inception. It will continue to be until passing the torch to some other administration who we hope will also be equally committed to education. We have scores on our kindergarten readiness assessments that are just not where they need to be.
Yeah. And in fact, Sam, the data came out today showing a 2% drop in kindergarten readiness.
Exactly. And so our kindergarten readiness scores are not where they need to be. The national average is significantly higher, upwards of 18% higher than what it is in Kentucky. And so we want to address that. We have seen not only in Kentucky, but elsewhere, and we were charged with looking at all the states that have pre-K programs. We have seen that kids that are in a formal setting, like private childcare, nonprofits, Head Start, or publicly funded preschool, do better on kindergarten readiness assessments than kids that are in no formal setting. And it just makes sense. They're in a classroom or some sort of learning environment. They have some structure. They have an adult. They have rules that they need to follow. And so it makes sense. I've heard directly from legislators, some that are current educators, that say, look, you know, with some of these kids that are staying home with mom or dad or grandma or grandpa, and they're not in a formal setting, it takes weeks, sometimes months in kindergarten to get them sort of corralled and back on the right track. So we want kids to get that good, strong start. And we know that kids in preschool tend to do better throughout their academic journeys. From third grade, we saw test scores in Mississippi and in Georgia. And we looked at states that look a lot like Kentucky, southern states, Midwestern states, red states, purple states, blue states. The data was pretty much the same throughout. Kids are better mathematicians and better readers in third grade. They're better mathematicians and readers in sixth grade and in eighth grade. We saw in Oklahoma, kids that attended preschool were 6 percentage points more likely to graduate, 12 percentage points more likely to go to college. In Boston, they were 6 percentage points more likely to graduate high school. And to bring that home, in Kentucky, the data is the same. Kentucky kids that attend a formal setting prior to kindergarten do better on kindergarten readiness assessments. Now, what does that mean for sort of the other aspects? So outside of the educational piece, well, it also means cost savings in other areas that are indirectly impacted. So we saw in the data that kids that attended preschool were less likely to be absent from school. They were less likely to have disciplinary issues. They were less likely to report as adults suffering from any kind of substance abuse. They were less likely to report having any kind of jail time or arrest. And they were more likely to report having health insurance and being employed. So you can see that this is an impact that stretches all the way through a child's learning career and into their life. Now, that's the educational component.
And I think I want to underscore, Sam, with the case that you're making, the return on investment for early childhood. So economists over and over again have shown that significant return and have calculated that significant return for the public investment along the lines of all the outcomes you just mentioned. So the investment in early childhood really does raise all boats, if you will, not only in education, but in spillovers from education, so in health outcomes, in outcomes to the workforce, et cetera. And I think voters and those responding to polls understand that importance. I think they understand the early childhood brain development and that it's a really important time, 0 to 3, 0 to 5, that youngsters have the right developmental environment and that families have the right supports to help their littlest learner develop and be ready for school. So I have the report in front of me of the advisory council, and you mentioned looking at many other states. What were the findings relative to what other states might be doing that Kentucky is not doing to expand access to early learning?
The first thing is we're just not serving enough children. And that's the biggest takeaway here. In Kentucky, we serve about 25%, give or take, of our 54,000 four-year-olds. Another significant chunk of those 54,000 are served in the nonprofit and private regulated childcare sector. And we certainly appreciate that sector that provide an invaluable service to the Commonwealth in what they do. But together, we're not serving all of the kids. So there's a significant portion of kids, particularly from working families, that do not qualify for Head Start or public preschool and cannot afford to send their kids to private regulated childcare. And I want to underscore this as well. There's a lot of places in Kentucky, a lot of places, and we're all familiar with them. My dad is from Lee County. There is no private childcare in a lot of parts of the state. We had the superintendent from Robertson County at one of our town halls, and he said, look, we're the only business in the game in terms of early childhood education. And other counties have similar stories. Martin County, where parents are driving to other counties to drop their kids off at daycare because there's just so little childcare access throughout the state. So in many cases, the Head Start or the preschool are the only game in town. And so increasing the access through that program and through our public pre-K, it'll reach more kids. It's going to help more families, particularly our working families. And this is something I want to go back to your prior question when we talked about the reason for this. And I talked a lot about the educational pieces, didn't get to the workforce pieces, but this is going to have a massive workforce impact in Kentucky. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important to the governor as well, is helping Kentuckians get back to work. There's a lot of Kentuckians out there, 40 to 70,000 who would return to work, but for access to preschool. And those aren't my numbers. Those are the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce have said that. The Trump administration in 2019 said that 10.4 million Americans would return to work, but for access to childcare. And 83% of those are women. So we're talking about moms and helping moms reenter the workforce. 2 months ago, the Wall Street Journal put out an article about why pre-K is good for parents as employees. It's because, number one, they're more likely to hold a job. They're more likely to work one job instead of two, and they're less likely to change jobs. So this is about helping families get back in the workforce, earning up to 21% more, and those earnings persisting over 6 years. That was a study that was done just last year. And stabilizing our workforce. And when new businesses come to the Commonwealth, and we've made a lot of big announcements in the last couple of years, they ask, what are you doing about infrastructure? And we're doing a lot. And they ask, what are you doing about early childhood education? And the answer to that is, well, we're not doing as much as we need to do. And this is going to be a recruiting tool because we are competing against other states in our region and nationally for these new investments to help build our communities and build up our economy here in Kentucky.
And I think that's a really important note, that as businesses look to locate in the state, they do wonder what the supports are for working families. And we talk about childcare, we talk about preschool. For the average listener, they may think that's all the same. But Sam, help us understand, as you approach an ask for universal preschool, how that might bring together the different early learning sectors that make Kentucky's early childhood system more efficient and effective in serving working families.
First thing I want to mention is, so this is not a quote unquote universal pre-K program. This is about a voluntary program. So we're wanting to expand access. In Kentucky, we want that to be voluntary always, as it has been in the past, because families get to make that choice. And we certainly encourage families to choose the option that is best for them. The hard part is some families don't have options to choose. And that's what we're really here trying to address. And I think that's what's at the crux of your question. So we have essentially three different ways that early childcare education is delivered in Kentucky. You have federally funded Head Start, which serves about 6,000 four-year-olds in Kentucky. You have public pre-K, which is funded by state dollars, which is provided through school districts and sometimes in partnership with private or nonprofit entities and Head Starts, providing services to about 14,000 kids at the four-year-old level, as we mentioned. And then we have private childcare facilities proper. And those are sort of broken down into a number of subsets, whether they're facilities or in-home care or what have you. And they provide a significant service. All three, if you measure the kindergarten readiness of the kids that are in any one of those type of programs, they do better on kindergarten readiness assessments than kids that are in no formal setting. So our aiming point is really the kids that just don't qualify for the programs like Head Start or public pre-K, and their families are just not able to afford private childcare or can't find it. Now, with respect to the recommendations in our report, because we value Head Start and private nonprofit childcare so highly, we have actually encouraged in our report that there be partnerships at the local level so that school districts can partner with Head Starts, can partner with YMCAs, can partner with other entities to actually provide these services. In some cases, school districts want to do that. And in many cases, that's parent-led because parents want to choose specific options. This one may be more to their liking than another setting. And we certainly encourage that.
So from a policy standpoint, bringing together the different delivery components, the different services, into a more efficient and effective system, my guess is that's what we may be seeing in other states across the country, where they are improving access for more folks and creating the conditions for more opportunity and access.
Absolutely right. And I just want to preface this. I know that when we're talking about education, we try to stay away from talking in the partisan context, but I think it's helpful for this and for the listeners to understand what the picture is. If you're looking at a map, you know, of sort of the electoral politics and what states are red states and what states are blue state, particularly Southern and Midwestern red states have really grasped onto expanding preschool access and doing so through what some might call a mixed delivery model, where lots of different types of providers can participate and help expand the pie in terms of service provided. So whether it's the Head Start, whether it's the school district, whether it's a YMCA or a private childcare provider, that more can provide services and therefore more children have access. And that's ultimately, I think, where we're trying to get. We had Gina Ross, Republican state legislator from Alabama, who helped lead their early childhood education department for several years. And during that time, expanding preschool options in Alabama, talk about how this is not a partisan issue, number one. Number two, that their families in Alabama love their program because it provides so many options and because it provides so much access to families that prior didn't. And I will put this in context for Kentuckians. For many years, Kentucky was a leader in early childhood education and in preschool access throughout the country. Alabama didn't even have a program until right around 2000, 2001. They have since surpassed us in the amount of kids served. That happened in 2019. So we're a little bit behind and we need to really start playing catch up. And that's what we've heard from parents. That's what we've heard from the business community. That's what we've heard from early childhood educators and superintendents throughout the state, and frankly, legislators as well. And we've met with over 70 members of the General Assembly thus far and having really, really great conversations about how we can move the ball forward in a smart way, in a thoughtful way, in a way that's good for our families and our communities.
We know we'll be hearing much more about the report and the issue of early childhood in the months to come and certainly through the 2026 legislative session. Sam Flynn, Executive Director of the Kentucky Pre-K for All Program and Special Advisor to Governor Beshear, thank you for being with us on Eastern Standard.
Thank you so much, Bridget.
Bridget Blom is President and CEO of the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence, a supporter of WEKU. Coming up after the break, some great holiday storytelling from Joseph Anthony, Crystal Wilkinson, Georgia Green Stamper, and Silas House. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at weku.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. Well, as we settle into this season of holidays, we've dipped into the 2022 holiday edition of Eastern Standard to bring back four Kentucky writers and poets with stories about love, determination, kindness, the quiet rituals and the complicated memories, and the small flashes of joy that shape this time of year. From novelist and poet Joseph Anthony, the story of the ugliest Christmas tree.
The snow had drifted into the crevice so that it all looked like a level surface. Frank hadn't remembered this much flat land. He thought his 3 acres was all up and down, except for the shelf made for his house and a few yards stretched out from his front door. His back door opened onto a deck that spiraled over a small canyon. But they'd only been in the house since October and hadn't explored all the land. And here was a flat field not more than a couple hundred yards from the house. But he should have known better. Nothing was level in eastern Kentucky. His boot kept plunging through the white powder, looking for solid ground. When he found it, he was up to his waist. Rockefeller Center. That was the first thought he had as he pulled himself up out of the ditch, which was odd. Frank had never liked Rockefeller Center. Even in 1980, it still had that 1930s Ayn Rand neo-fascist look. But if anything said New York Christmas, it did. He looked over the white wilderness in front of him. He should have brought a stick to poke the drifts. It'd be hard to keep his footing. A fallen beech blocked his way. Beech? Sycamore, maybe. He tried to remember if that's what the surveyor had said was the border edge of his 3 acres. He had never owned a foot of land in Manhattan. He grabbed the branch of the beech, or whatever it was, and pulled himself up and over, put his small axe down first. "Going to chop us some wood, honey?" They did have a wood stove, but mostly for decoration. The heat pump worked just fine. "Going to chop our own Christmas tree," he told her, trying not to sound too ridiculous. Elaine nodded vaguely. Christmas was all part of the baggage that came with marrying a goy. But even Elaine had liked Rockefeller Center, with its giant Norway spruce brought down from Vermont, the skaters, the whole Fifth Avenue crush of shoppers. Even if you could only afford the window shop or look at the skaters. When you got too cold, you could always duck into St. Patrick's across the street. None of it was particularly Christian. They decked the altar with green boughs and spread pine trees out to the entranceway. Mixed with the candles burning, the smell was pure New York. You forgave a lot of New York sins during Christmas week. He stepped carefully over the fallen tree, but slipped on some hidden iced rock and tumbled forward over the hill. He spread his arms out, trying to catch his balance, as if he were going to take flight, and did a snow angel face down. His words, not very angel-like, were muffled by the snow. The land was full of pitfalls. He could hear some dogs starting to bark in the distance. "You going where?" "Kentucky. Hazard, Kentucky." His friend Stan had roped him into going out to Belmont in June, a week before the big race. "Hazard? That near Churchill?" "I don't think so. It's in the mountains." "Mountains?" Stan's eyes were momentarily torn from the racing form. "Man, you're going to get shot. Kentucky feuds." Frank didn't remind Stan of his own shooting. Some junkie thinking Stan wasn't moving fast enough emptying his pockets. Or Frank's own gun-to-the-head experience when the place he managed had been robbed the year before. He didn't think Kentucky mountains could be more dangerous. But that had been the general reaction of his friends. Either an old stereotype about moonshine and feuds or a blank stare. Mostly blank stares. His friend's New Jersey was across the river and Los Angeles across the country. But they were vague about the stuff in between. He picked himself up again and brushed the snow from his face. He looked around for his axe. "Well, bring a big tree back, honey, and maybe some bagels and lox." Elaine had been a blank stare, too, when he told her he had gotten a job at the community college. But Elaine never stayed blank for long. She jumped right in, knew enough to answer all their friends who just scratched their heads in befuddlement, even her mother, who cried, actually cried, about her daughter and grandbaby being brought to the wilderness. "Mother, Daniel Boone's been gone a long time." But she still missed her bagel and lox. And he guessed he still missed Fifth Avenue. But he'd just been a window shopper there. He owned this place. At 17 months, their baby, Emily, wouldn't care how big the tree was. Anything sparkly would do. And Elaine sure didn't care as long as it wasn't too big. But this was his first Kentucky Christmas. He wanted something impressive, something that said woods and outdoors, not like the corner lot trees he'd dragged home in New York. They had said Long Island Tree Farm. Only his hill was on the north side. The real estate agent had mentioned that, and he had nodded, as if she were explaining the difference between west side and east side. But now he understood. Every promising candidate tree he approached, full, lush, green, turned bare, brown, spare when turned around, like a Potemkin village facade, all front, no rear. Elaine would laugh him out of town if he brought home one of those sorry specimens. The snow was deeper than he had thought. Three snowfalls adding up. The road that led down from his house had disappeared. They'd been parking on Route 15 by the mailboxes since the first snowfall, been trudging their way up since. "We could call the city for their snowplows," Elaine had teased one trip. She was carrying groceries. He had put on the baby backpack, which Emily always treated like a trampoline. Each jump doubled her weight of 25 pounds, and he was sweating. Their house was a half mile straight up from the road. "Don't think they have snowplows. Besides, we're in the county, not their jurisdiction." But they liked those hikes. They had to pause for breath every 100 yards or so, and it gave them time to look over the mountains. The trees crowded in close to the path they were making. In the summer, they couldn't see the river for all the leaves. But the river was there now, a black line cutting through the white of the banks. The south hills on the other side just had patches of snow left. They wondered if they'd have to wait for March for a thaw on the north side. He spotted a likely tree candidate, halfway up the next incline. It was separated from the other trees in a little clearing of its own. Maybe it had had sun enough to fill out all the way around. He picked his way carefully down the hill and started to climb back up towards the tree. It was probably 8 feet tall. Elaine wouldn't laugh, at least. He wondered if his axe was big enough. 6 feet from the tree, he heard a click. He had heard that click the year before when he was robbed. He froze, and then slowly turned his head towards it. An old woman held a rifle, half as big as she was. It was pointed off to the side and looked heavy. It was all she could do to hold it steady. Two large dogs stood by her side, glued by some unspoken command. Unlike the gun, they pointed directly at him. "You lost, mister?" "No," he managed to say. "I'm looking for a Christmas tree." "They sell Christmas trees in town." "I wanted to chop my own, on my own land." The rifle had swayed closer to the ground. The old woman pulled it back up. She was wearing a man's coat that reached past her waist, though it was just a jacket. Her galoshes looked like men's, too. They reached her knees. She had pulled a knit cap over her white hair. She looked like she had dressed quick. "This ain't your land." "It's not?" Frank thought of the fallen beach. "Oh, I'm sorry. It's hard to tell in all the snow." "It ain't hard to tell if you know where you're at." She looked at the axe he still held in his hand. "That what you aiming to do, to chew your chopping?" He looked at the axe again, himself. It looked like a toy. The blade could have been made of rubber. He shrugged. The old woman lowered the gun. He heard another click. Something like a smile passed over her face. "You're that professor who bought the Ritchie house. Got that pretty baby. Shouldn't be wandering around folks' property carrying axes. Even axes like that. Makes the dogs nervous. I'm sorry, Oh, no harm done. Except maybe to you. Look like you took a few tumbles. Why don't you come down to the house, get you something warm to drink? And I might have something better to chop that tree with than that baby axe you're carrying." She nodded to the tree he'd been stalking. "But that's your tree. It's on your land." "Oh, mister, I got more trees than I know what to do with. Besides, it's a sorry-looking thing on the other side. Good Christmas trees don't grow in these mountains, mister. You'll need flat land for that. Still, you're welcome to it if you want it. Come on down and get you something to drink first." She turned with the rifle slung over her shoulders. The dogs trailed back to him, wagging tail friendly now. Some invisible sign having been made to them that he was okay. The old woman plied him with two mugs of hot cider before he got away. Her man was gone, but her sons checked in on her regularly, and the grandbabies would be over Christmas. She gave him an axe as big as her rifle. He could bring it back when the snow thawed. Did he think it was ever? She pulled out a rag doll she had made out of old socks. Didn't know why, since her sons just had boys. "You think your little girl would like that?" she asked shyly. He thanked her, but she waved it away. "I hope I didn't scare you none with that old gun. Can hardly lift it anymore with the arthritis. But my boys make me keep it, living out here alone by myself." "You look like you knew what you were doing." She looked at him steady. "Oh, I know how to shoot it, if that's what you mean." The dogs had fallen asleep in front of the coal stove, but pricked their ears up at her tone. But the old woman was smiling again, and they lay back down. Elaine laughed when he dragged the tree 8 foot in. One whole side was missing. "Frank, that's the ugliest Christmas tree I've ever seen. It's a mountain tree." Emily reached for a branch. Bringing trees indoors was a new treat for her. She didn't care about Rockefeller Center. He picked Emily up, and they both nuzzled the green pine. It smelt as good as any Norway spruce. He grinned back at his wife. It's made right here in Kentucky, and we think it's beautiful.
Joseph Anthony, author of The Ugliest Christmas Tree. In the pages of A Kentucky Christmas, edited by George L. Lyon, we found a pair of offerings from two former Kentucky Poets Laureate. Tom Eblin had a conversation with one. I'll have another later in the hour.
I'm speaking today with Crystal Wilkinson. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Well, Crystal is an award-winning novelist and short story writer and an associate professor at the University of Kentucky. The book A Kentucky Christmas includes her poem, The Visit. Crystal, could you read that poem for us?
Certainly. The Visit. Mama, it was like Christmas on Sundays when you came to the creek. Your arms always heavy with dolls, tea sets, chocolate-covered cherries or candy corn. Your eyes searching my face for a daughter's smile, scanning me with a mother's familiarity to find the inches I'd grown. You seemed a foreigner to me, some sweet dignitary returning from holiday, all dressed to the nines, but you were my mama, hair slicked back, a long tight skirt that skimmed the narrow in your hips, and always a lipstick-stained cigarette. In my best red dress and my black patent leathers, my hair pressed and curled, I received you with belly round hugs dressed like Sunday school. I breathed in your perfume, traded my Mary Janes for your high-heeled pumps, painted my lips with your ruby red and tangerine. We played house under the stare of Granny's eye, kissed on the lips, held hands like we thought mothers and daughters should. But neither of us knew for sure. These were the days of our beginnings when mothering and daughtering was bright and brand new. And when you left, I love you so good, you would say. Your hugs were tight, so tight they took my breath away. I clung to you in those times, hoping I could grow heavy in your arms like a gift.
Wow, that's such a powerful poem. You know, I think part of the power is that it speaks to complex family relationships and dynamics that always seem to become even more complex this time of year. I guess it's a time of year when everybody wants a perfect family, and of course, nobody really has a perfect family. What was Christmas like growing up with your grandparents?
Pretty magical, as Christmas is for most children in families who practice those traditions. You know, I consider myself kind of old-fashioned now because I was grandparent-raised. My grandmother made popcorn and strung the popcorn, and we had gifts, and she would send out Bible verses or little speeches to all the kids in the family, all my first cousins, and we'd have a big church program. But my mother coming in to visit was always a big part of it, and that was always exciting for me. But, you know, of course, I realized as an adult how uncomfortable it was for my grandmother because of my mother's mental illness. She wasn't sure what to expect.
Mm-hmm. Well, so how have those relationships affected you over the years, and especially, you know, things like family time at Christmas and other holidays?
A lot of what I do is the cooking and trying to enter those old traditions in some ways and give honor to the ways that my grandparents and people like them lived in rural Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. What is it about the holidays that I guess it seems like we all want to be closer to family and have that nurturing, even though that's often difficult?
I think it's nostalgia. I think that it's the solstice time that people want to come together to celebrate and honor time-old traditions. For my family, even though we don't necessarily do it in a traditional way or with the same reasonings as my grandparents, I think the harvest celebration or Thanksgiving and Christmas are important times to come together and to remember and to look back. And, you know, it's part of ritual, which I think is innate mm-hmm. in us all. So I think those times are part of sort of ritualistic gatherings to celebrate.
Well, what advice do you have for families? You know, how do you kind of negotiate family time in such really complicated situations?
It is difficult, but I think that, you know, if you can sort of get in where you fit in, and that sounds kind of flip, but I think that you have to start new traditions. If you can't sort of fit, insert yourself into the old ones, and I think it's a time to be peaceful and meditate on how things were and sort of draw nostalgia in and gather those memories. I think that celebrations can be held in a myriad of ways without, you know, going to the store and coming out the other side broke. I think a lot of it is, should be about family and traditions. And sometimes you just have to meet people where they are. I think there is a time for fighting too, and making your point known. But I think in addition to that, sort of choosing your battles and sort of meeting people where they are is a big part of getting through those holidays.
Eastern Standard Kentucky Literature contributor Tom Eblen with author, poet, Crystal Wilkinson. Another treasure from that December 2022 show comes from essayist, author, storyteller, Georgia Green Stamper.
When I was a child, I thought the three wise men and the shepherds really had worn bathrobes and black socks when they came to adore the Christ child. This was the way they were always dressed in the Christmas pageant at our church, and I assumed the costuming was historically accurate. I wasn't quite sure why biblical men had wrapped terry cloth towels around their heads, but since Christmas is often cold in Kentucky, I figured they probably wanted to keep their bald heads warm. Our tiny Methodist church thought big, and we staged an elaborate reenactment of the Christmas story every year, although the director made an annual announcement that she would never do this again. To pull this off, everyone in the congregation was drafted into service. Even the youngest served as stable animals, and the most elderly turned the light switches on and off at critical moments. Were it not for the kindness of the Baptists across the road, we would have played to empty pews. We cast them as the audience, and they obliged by dismissing their Sunday night service to help us out. I can still recall the angels' wings. They were shaped out of baling wire from the hayfield, and then were covered from span to span with multiple layers of ivory crepe paper. A creative, genial woman who died much too young tediously shaped the overlapping layers of fragile paper into thousands of feather-like ruffles. The wings were magnificent, and I'm pretty sure God added Margaret Carr's design to his pattern book. Our choir of angels who sang on high was small, but their voices were fine and pure and covered every part. Mr. and Mrs. Bell could not be equaled at bass and alto. Cousin May hit the soprano notes with the skill of a trained opera singer. And Bill, who later became a Baptist but got his start in the Methodist choir, sang a fine tenor. And his future wife, Faye, handled the keyboard with skill. There were a few other angels, too, even me, but mostly we only hummed. Mrs. Prather was a perennial director, and in real life, she was a fifth-grade schoolteacher accustomed to being obeyed. Every year, about halfway through the month of rehearsals, she would have a mild breakdown, alternately crying and then yelling, because no one was listening to her. Once she spoke sharply to a wise man who'd been hastily recruited to fill a bathrobe from the ranks of loitering boyfriends hanging around the Methodist Youth Fellowship. Now, admittedly, he was flirting when he should have been following yonder star, but he was so taken aback at being reprimanded that he vowed never to darken the door of a church again. I hope he didn't keep that vow. I'd hate to think our Christmas pageant sent him straight to hell. Years later, though, whenever I found myself standing in the midst of pandemonium trying to lead people who did not want to be led, Have you ever tried to build gingerbread houses with 20 brownie Girl Scouts in a very tiny room? I would think about Mrs. Prather and carry on for her sake. I wish I'd told her when I could how much the pageants meant to me. One memory in particular remains vivid. Our shepherds were no-nonsense farmers, recruited from the adult men's Sunday school class. I can only imagine how their Christian faith was tested when they were asked to don ridiculous-looking bathrobes in public, wrap towels around their heads, and come to play practice every Sunday afternoon. To compound their stage misery, one year Mrs. Prather surprised the shepherds at our first rehearsal by altering the perennial silent tableau. "This Christmas, the shepherds would have lines to recite," she said. Then she instructed the shepherds to move forward one by one and read their assigned paragraphs. When shepherd number two was called upon, he gamely stepped up. He read the first word, "the," but then stopped. He looked at the floor. He cleared his throat. And in an instant, I understood. Shepherd number two could not read, at least not well. He was one of the most honorable, pleasant men I've ever met, hardworking and capable. I'm sure that in today's schools, he would have been diagnosed with dyslexia or some other synapse glitch that made reading more difficult for him than for others. But in that awful moment, he stood mute on the altar of the church. That's when the good thing happened. Without a look passing between them, the other shepherds began to read the lines for him. Their tongues turned to silver, and then they seamlessly moved on to their own. The wise men joined in, too. I've never heard a choral reading more deftly executed. The powerful rhythm of their conjoined voices erased all embarrassment, and we went on to have the best rehearsal we ever had. By the next Sunday, shepherd number two had memorized his lines, and the incident was never spoken of. And so it came to pass that I learned the true meaning of Christmas from farmers wearing bathrobes with towels on their heads. Whenever I find myself uncertain of my performance in life, I think about those good men, unsure of themselves too, but unafraid to look ridiculous in the trying.
Georgia Queen Stamper. Another among the more than 60 Kentucky stories featured in A Kentucky Christmas is When She Came to Mercy by Silas House.
Hello, Tom. Good to talk to you.
There are two characters in this story. Tell us about them.
Well, first of all, the story is set at Christmas 1899. And so some of the story revolves around the fact that there was quite a bit of superstition around the turn of the century and into 1900, into the 20th century, the same way that we sort of reacted to going into the 21st century. And so Mercy is an older lady who's living by herself up in a holler, and her only living child lives pretty far away. But she's very self-reliant, and she's really determined to remain there in that isolated place as long as she can. And one day she goes out to get some coal, and she sees a girl, a young woman, up on the mountain coming down towards her. And so then she discovers that Susanna has been turned out by her parents, particularly her father, because she's gotten pregnant. And I think she's around 16 or 17. And so she's just sort of, you know, she's homeless and doesn't know what to do except to walk. And she's just about numb and happens to stumble upon Mercy.
And so Mercy discovers that this girl's name is Susanna, and that really meant mm-hmm. something to her.
Well, I think that it gives the story a bit of a magical realism feel to some degree. It's revealed that Mercy had a child who has died, who was also named Susanna, and she hasn't said that name aloud since her daughter died. And so right away, she's taken by this young woman, not only by the situation she's in and the fact that she needs help, but also that she has her dead daughter's name. So she's just sort of instantly endeared to her on a few levels.
She invites this girl to stay with her. And the next day, they go together out on the mountain to gather greenery for Christmas. And something happened while they were out there.
Well, Mercy stumbles. And, you know, I think she's starting to realize that her age is really catching up with her. She feels pretty feeble, although she's never going to admit that. But I think it's a moment of her realizing her own mortality and sort of thinking about the dangers of living alone for someone her age and her shape. But Susanna, you know, is willing to stay there with her as long as she needs her to. And it's this moment that sort of the story comes full circle, because in the beginning, Susanna needs Mercy's help, and by the end, Mercy realizes that she could use Susanna's help. And so I think it's a really endearing moment that we come to care for both of the characters, because we've been able to see both their vulnerabilities, you know.
Well, we won't spoil the ending for our listeners, but is there a message?
For me, it made sense to write a story about what we should be doing always, not just at Christmas. That we should be helping each other, that we should be trying to be the best people we can be, that kindness is the main thing that matters. There's something about the season that makes us want to be better people. And if we could just carry that through the whole year, the world would be a really different place. But that's what it means to me. You have these two people who need help, and they help each other.
Our thanks to Silas House and to Joseph Anthony, Tom Eblen with Crystal Wilkinson, and Georgia Green Stamper. We'll be back on January 8th to introduce our new series, The AI Revolution, Promise and Peril, hosted by Art Sheckett. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Our interviews are online at esweku.org. While you're there, you can check out our contributors and their interviews. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Have a question or a topic to suggest? If you would like to hear your question or suggestion as the prompt for a segment on Eastern Standard, record it on your smart device and send us the MP3 with your first name only and location. You can email it as an attachment to es@eku.edu with question for ES in the subject line. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.